chalk it up to bad genes. Amanda Saint-Amour struggles with a lot of health conditions.
I have Crohn's disease, I have diabetes, high blood pressure, high triglycerides, and I had a stroke. And from all of this, I am on medication for depression as well.
She's 30, lives in Merrimack, and pulls out a small laundry basket full of pill bottles.
Basically, I take between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, about 15 pills a morning.
There's one pill missing from the stack, a drug called Trilipix. Saint-Amour has taken it for years and says it helps keep her triglyceride levels down. But when she switched jobs recently, she switched health insurance. The new insurer refused to cover it, explaining its decision in a letter.
I have the denial letter here. We gave individual consideration based on the material available to us. We could not approve coverage of this service because you did not meet the medical necessity criteria required for coverage of Trilipix because there was no documented treatment failure with two covered alternatives.
Saint-Amour hasn't taken these two alternatives because Wendy Wright won't prescribe them. She's her nurse practitioner, and she's worried about the risk of a negative interaction with some of Saint-Amour's other prescriptions. Now, Trilipix runs around $190 for a month's supply. The alternative medicine, just $54. Wright says she constantly runs into these battles.
When I choose a medicine that I think is right for that patient, I do it for a reason, not because of cost. I do it because I think it's the best medicine for that patient.
The industry calls the tactic of trying certain low-cost alternatives first step therapy. A patient starts with the cheapest drug, and if that doesn't work, moves up the steps to a more expensive one. But opponents call the practice fail first, and they've introduced legislation that would limit how many times insurers can mandate a drug failure in New Hampshire. Senator Sharon Carson is the prime sponsor.
How many times does a person have to fail? How much pain do they have to go through or some sort of an adverse reaction in order to get the medication that the doctor wanted them to have in the first place?
Carson's bill, which sailed through the Senate, doesn't seek to completely outlaw steps. Instead, it would limit the number of fails to one. So if you go through the steps and eventually land on a higher-priced drug, an insurer couldn't, down the line, force you to try that same generic again. The rule would also apply if you switch insurers.
What this legislation does is it tries to balance. It balances the needs of the insurance companies, but it also balances the needs of the patients.
Then there are the needs of drug companies. They see the steps more as hurdles to their blockbuster drugs. Pfizer is lobbying for the bill in New Hampshire, and similar legislation is pending in other New England states, suggesting a coordinated effort. A handful of states already have such bans in place. Insurance carriers, for their part, say steps make sense. In a statement, Anthem writes that, quote, step therapy programs are carefully developed using clinical guidelines and have proven effective in decreasing costs without compromising care. And the concept that doctors start with a cheaper alternative does have traction in the field. Travis Harker is a family physician and current president of the New Hampshire Medical Society.
Doctors and patients both agree they want the right medicine, but they also want a cost-effective medicine. They don't want to go bankrupt each month trying to buy a medication that maybe is the same or maybe has even marginal benefit over something that's generic.
The Medical Society does support the bill, but Harker says his bigger frustration is the time and resources doctors spend trying to figure out just what an insurer will cover. Amanda Saint-Amour and her nurse practitioner have been fighting for coverage of Trilipix for a month now.
I hope that, you know, we're able to get it covered eventually. Maybe if the practitioners keep sending in letters to my insurance company, because there's only so much I can do as one person versus the healthcare industry.
The proposed step therapy legislation hasn't been scheduled for a vote yet in the New Hampshire House. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Yeah, I'm Jim Hoyt. I'm from Alexandria. I live up on the Washburn Road. It's wet, very wet. I've been down here since 8 o'clock shoveling snow to put the canopy up. The issue with me is, and a lot of people in town, is the Wild Meadows wind farm that's going in. So far I feel it's pretty positive. I think they're voting yes against the windmills, which really doesn't have a lot of impact. The SEC will have to look at it. There are people that are just catching wind of it, believe it or not, want to know what was going on. So I told them, and they couldn't believe it.
I'm Peter Brown from Alexandria. I'm changing a little. I was all for wind farms and the alternate force of energy. I've got to find more about find out more about them now, because I've heard some things that aren't all pleasant and positive.
Hello.
How are you doing, neighbor?
Good, how are you?
My name is Jenny Madden. I live in Groton. Well, personally, I love them. I think they're majestic, and I think they look great around here. It gives you something to look at. No, I think most people in Groton like the wind farms. I like what we have, and that's enough for now.
Dave Donegan. I don't know. It's
The crowded hearing in Representatives Hall got underway mid-morning. It opened with Committee Chair Mary Jane Wallner asking the crowd to acknowledge the bombing in Boston.
What I would like to do first is for all of us to stand and have a moment of silence.
Governor Maggie Hassan was the first to testify on the bill. She took the floor to applause. She then quieted the crowd with her own acknowledgement of the Boston attacks.
Just add that on behalf of the people of New Hampshire, I've expressed that our prayers and our thoughts are with the people of Boston and Massachusetts and everybody who was impacted by yesterday's events.
Hassan then barreled through a spirited 12-minute sales pitch for the policy that so far defined her governorship.
Senate Bill 152 allows for the licensing of one high-end, highly regulated destination casino in New Hampshire that will bring hundreds of millions of dollars.
When she was done, Hassan invited lawmakers to question her on the bill. But not a one of the 45 committee members did.
Seeing no questions, I thank you very much for appearing before us today.
Thank you very much for having
your testimony.
Good luck
thank
with
you.
Your work, folks.
Much of what followed during the four-hour hearing were familiar arguments. Gambling backers like Democratic Senator Lou D'Alessandro pitched the bill as an unadulterated boon.
Senate Bill 152 is an economic recovery job creation package. Let me repeat that. It's an economic recovery job creation package.
Representative David Campbell of Nashua, meanwhile, warned that not allowing a casino with up to 5,000 slot machines and 150 table games would leave New Hampshire the victim of casinos being built in Massachusetts.
If we do nothing, we will build a funnel on our border, and the giant sucking sound you hear, it'll be hundreds of millions of dollars going to fill Massachusetts' budget coffers instead of hundreds of million dollars for our own state New Hampshire budget.
But those opposed to the bill cast...
Ed Talbot is the picture of a put-together guy. He sits in a Boston cafe, well-dressed, his silver hair carefully buzz-cut, and a manila folder full of facts and figures within easy reach. But he admits his life wasn't always this organized. 35 years ago, it was a mess. He was addicted to gambling.
And finally, on the last night of racing at Taunton Dog Track, November 30th, 1977, I put whatever money I had left on a dog by the name of Perfect Treasure. The starting box opened, the dogs came out, and Perfect Treasure fell. And my dream world came crashing down. 5 days later, I was contemplating suicide with a dive off a bridge.
Like many gambling addicts, the road to rock bottom was a long one for Talbot. Over 8 years, he gained weight, smoked 3 packs a day. His wife kicked him out of the house. His mother begged him to stop on her deathbed. And then there was his daughter.
With so many times when she was growing up, gymnastics routines, you know, she was big into gymnastics. I was never there. Birthday parties, Daddy had to take off and go to the track.
Since that last race in 1977, Talbot hasn't gambled at all. And he's now working to establish a New Hampshire chapter of the Council on Problem Gambling to help others. He says the state doesn't have nearly enough prevention or treatment services in place.
If you go on the 211 line for services, there's not even a mention of problem gambling. So, you know, who do you call?
Not a gambling addiction counselor. About half of all states, including Massachusetts, certify specialists in problem gambling. New Hampshire doesn't. And Talbot says substance abuse counselors aren't effective substitutes. The best bet for help in New Hampshire is to find one of the 5 Gamblers Anonymous meetings. They're all in the southern part of the state.
It's intensely and extraordinarily frustrating.
Keith White heads the National Council on Problem Gambling in Washington, D.C. The council's hotline ends up taking a lot of calls from here. Over an 18-month period, the group counted almost 1,000 calls from New Hampshire. White says no one knows for sure how many people in the state might have a problem with gambling. His group provides a wide estimate of somewhere between 13,000 and 40,000. If someone does call the hotline, the group refers him or her to one of those five Gamblers Anonymous meetings, or in a pinch, to Alcoholics Anonymous. While the council is adamantly neutral on all casino debates, White says he's worried about how New Hampshire would handle expanded gaming.
New Hampshire is, of course, one of the oldest modern U.S. lotteries. To still not provide any services, not provide any funding for problem gambling, that doesn't set a very good track record. Even if New Hampshire were to put tons of money into problem gambling programs now with this new casino bill, there's no infrastructure whatsoever to build on. So we're very concerned that the state would be able to manage this in a responsible manner.
The Senate-passed bill, SB 152, does address gambling addiction. It calls for an estimated $1.7 million to go toward treatment and prevention in 2015. Within a couple years, the state figures that number would shoot up to about $4.5 million. Once a casino is fully established, the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies estimates the state could have to pay up to $3.7 million for treatment and prevention each year.
So then there are a whole other set of things that are probably worth talking about at some point. One is the
Steve Norton heads the Center for Public Policy Studies. He recently testified before a House subcommittee looking at social impacts of a casino. Opponents say that includes more bankruptcies and divorces, higher unemployment, more welfare claims, and property crimes.
Pathological gambling doesn't occur the instant that you put a casino up. Just like the revenue question, there's some timing associated with it. And that's particularly important if you're interested in developing programs designed to mitigate any potential pathological problem gambling.
Norton and other researchers also say that a few years after the initial spike in problem gambling, the numbers do start to go down. But in general, Professor Clyde Barrow of UMass Dartmouth says concerns about social costs are overblown. And that's what he told lawmakers.
Before the flashlight walk began, the family and friends of Abigail Hernandez spoke to the hundreds of people who had gathered. Nicole LaRouche is one of Hernandez's close friends.
Abby is one of the most amazing people I know. She changed me a lot as a person. Everybody knows that person who will always make you smile, and that is Abby. Everyone that she meets, they always remember her. She's a ball of happiness. We're all aching for her to be here. No one has lost hope, and no one ever will. And we will keep looking until she is brought home.
The crowd, most with flashlights, some with candles, then went off together in the dark, past the old Victorian train station, across the tracks, and down over the wide grassy ways of the North Conway golf course, and soon became like a long strand of Christmas lights being drawn away along a river. Paul Kirsch of the White Mountain Milers organized the vigil.
I mean, there's so many theories and things because it's unknown, and you have someone who just dropped off the face of the earth. You know, one of the most important things is that people kind of keep their eyes and ears open and reevaluate everything they remember from that day if they were near or anywhere near the area between Kennett High School and her house. And somebody somewhere is going to have something. I mean, people don't just disappear into thin air.
Brian Ames, carrying a lit candle in one hand, is one of the many who have searched for Hernandez.
Everybody's worried about her. Don't know if she got kidnapped or not, you know. Have no idea. I didn't know her. And I'm on a local fire department. I was out there searching for her for 2 days, and we found nothing. But they're still out there. Hopefully that she'll come home.
Until now, Abigail's mother, Xenia Hernandez, has shied away from reporters, except to issue pre-written statements. English is her second language, and she's been advised not to talk to the press. But she feels so strongly, like Paul Kirsch, that someone has valuable information about her daughter, that she agreed to speak.
We've been up and down. Sometimes we're very, very down, and sometimes we're very hopeful and very optimistic. A week ago, actually, I was just devastated. Devastated. But we are very hopeful, and as much as there's technology and everything else, we really rely on individuals and people and what they see. And there's somebody who either saw something that they just don't think it's important, and that's why they're not reporting it. Or maybe somebody saw something and they're afraid. But I do want to say that I do not feel that I'd be left voluntarily. I do not.
17-year-old Jess Taylor says Hernandez's disappearance has deeply affected the students at Kennett High.
I mean, for the first week or so, it was very we were all very quiet and nobody wanted to talk about it because we were all sad. But now it's just where is she? We need to find, it's more of an anxiety thing. I've been shaking all night. It's just more of a, we need to find her. We want to find her. We want to know what's happened. We're all very heavy hearted and it's just a thick sadness. You can almost feel it throughout the school. Nobody's really the same as they were before. And we really just want her to come home. We want there to be some big announcement during the day that they found Abby.
When Senator Kelly Ayotte stopped by Tilton for a town hall meeting this past May, gun control grabbed all the headlines. But some constituents also brought up a less familiar topic.
I'm very concerned about this Common Core that takes all the rights away from the states. It puts it smack dab into Washington. How do we get rid of this thing?
That concern is part of a growing conservative backlash against the Common Core standards, which are being phased into New Hampshire schools right now. New Hampshire was an early adopter of the standards in 2010, but many parents are just hearing about them. So, what are they? We thought we'd ask someone who helped to write them.
Standards themselves, they're not subversive.
David Pook has been teaching for 20 years and currently heads the history department at the Derryfield School. When the call went out for folks interested to help write the standards, he answered.
Reading standard number 4, explain how word choice contributes to tone. I think we can get behind that, guys, right? Reading standard 2, summarize a text. I think that's an important skill for folks to be able to have.
Pook explains that the standards are really just a set of goalposts that students are meant to get to every year, skills they're expected to master. For example, by the end of 6th grade, students should be able to, quote, solve real-world mathematical problems involving area, surface area, and volume. This is basically what the Common Core is, a big list of skills like that, but only for English and math. So, what's the big deal exactly? For many opponents, the Common Core initiative is a direct descendant of liberal efforts to enact a national curriculum in decades past. The national conservative group, the American Principles Project, put out a video called Stop the Common Core.
The real drivers of the Common Core were the same advocates of a national school curriculum who have been around for years in various guises. They tried and failed to impose a national curriculum in the past. For example, with the national history standards in the 1990s, which were so politically correct and anti-American that they were rejected by the U.S. Senate 99-1.
In New Hampshire, a small but focused group has been trying to bring attention to what they call an infringement on local control.
I think the longer this goes on, the more you're going to see a backlash.
Anne-Marie Banfield is the education liaison for Cornerstone Action, a conservative advocacy group.
Because this is a top-down approach, or whenever you take a top-down approach in anything, I think what happens is you didn't get the people at the bottom, you didn't get the grassroots, you didn't get the parents supporting this.
The Common Core comes from a collaboration between a number of different groups. The Council of Chief State School Officers, which is made up of the commissioners of education from every state, the National Governors Association, and ACHIEVE, a national group that works to raise academic standards. The federal government was not directly involved. The effort has received a lot of funding from the Gates Foundation, which also has pushed for tougher teacher evaluations that are based in part on their students' standardized test scores. But David Pook, the teacher who himself helped write part of the English standards, says the idea that the Common Core is a top-down reform misses the mark.
So when I hear the conspiracy message, I just have to say that in high school, I was a meat cutter and I saw how the sausage was made. And this was a process very similar to how the sausage was made.
That process included calling for...
It's Thursday at Twin Smoke Shop in Hooksett, which means it's alcohol, tobacco, and firearms night. 15 people mill around the cigar shop, puffing on cigars, drinking beer, and sure enough, they're packing heat.
You have a gun on you? I can't tell you've got a big jacket.
I do.
Can I see?
Yeah.
These are liberty-minded folks, mostly guys, one gal. They aren't paying that much attention to their guns, although I am. Most have pistols either holstered on a belt or tucked into the back of their pants. So I asked Mike Ruff, who lives in Manchester, to show me his M1911 pistol.
Come on now.
He rustles as he takes out the ammunition.
As you can see, at no time was it pointed in an unsafe direction. At most, it was pointed at me, so I was the only one who would get hurt if I did something wrong.
For Ruff, being trained and responsible is an important part of open carrying a loaded gun.
It's a visible signal that we do accept responsibility for defending ourselves, and that, hey, if somebody's not prepared to defend themselves, we're ready to voluntarily jump in and help.
People have been free to carry a loaded gun openly in New Hampshire since statehood. That is to say, there's never been a law that prohibits or even regulates it. It's the same with a lot of other states across the country. But over time, much of the public began to assume open carry was illegal. That is, until the summer of 2004. Then, according to the website opencarry.org, Second Amendment activists began making a statement by wearing their guns publicly, often to the chagrin of local law enforcement. Captain Bob Cunha has been policing Manchester for 25 years. Of course, it's impossible to know how many people open carry, since there's no permit or license required. But Cunha says he's witnessed more and more people open carrying over the last 10 years.
Open carry is legal, so it's not something that we create data on or track people on or things like that, because it is a right. Something we don't want to infringe upon.
Cunha is very careful not to step on any toes. His department learned that the hard way when a liberty group called the Ridley Report started filming incidents in which police wrongly stopped and questioned people for openly carrying weapons.
Why don't you back away and talk to us like normal people?
After those videos showed up on YouTube back in 2007, Cunha began giving officers extra training on gun laws. He wants to make sure police don't stop people just for open carrying. It should take reckless behavior to warrant intervention, or carrying a weapon in a courthouse, which is forbidden by the state, or on school property, which is prohibited by the feds. Antigone Darling is the only woman at that alcohol, tobacco, and firearms event in Hooksett. She leans against a wall and puffs on a cigar. She's in the process of shopping for a gun right now because she says she thinks wearing it will deter potential criminals.
And so if someone's considering mugging me, or worse, they might reconsider that if I'm open carrying.
But open carrying isn't just about self-defense. Mike Ruff and the others see themselves as protectors, both of their loved ones and of the public, ready to pull the trigger in case of an unexpected violent crime. In the city of Manchester, the odds of being involved in a violent crime are just 1 to 169. Now, that's more than 3 times higher than the rest of New Hampshire, but still very unlikely. Back at the cigar shop, Kirk McNeil isn't thinking too much about the odds of witnessing a murder. For him, knowing how to use a gun is more symbolic. It's about adulthood.
You should know how to change a tire, safely handle a firearm. You know, you should know how to cook dinner. You should know how to change a diaper, vacuum the floor, you know. They're just life skills that you should know how to do.
In fact, gun experts say there's no evidence that guns deter crime at all. And Harvard's health policy professor David...
A big day in the world of health policy, nationally and in New Hampshire. State regulators are still trying to gauge how to handle the president's offer to let consumers keep canceled insurance plans. And in Concord, lawmakers continue to negotiate over Medicaid expansion 1 week into a special legislative session. Here to break it all down for us is NHPR's health reporter Todd Bookman. Hi, Todd.
Good afternoon, Brady.
Let's start with Medicaid. Today's the halfway point on the 2-week-long special session that will decide if and how the state expands the health program for the poor. So where do things stand today?
Well, up in the air, Brady, for right now at least. There are still 2 different bills, one in the House, one in the Senate. The plans essentially start in the same place. Anyone who makes under about $16,000 a year would be eligible for Medicaid in 2014. If they already get insurance through their jobs, though, they would have to keep that insurance. Everyone else, and we're talking roughly 30 to 35,000 currently uninsured people, that group would enroll in one of the new managed care plans that all current Medicaid recipients are transitioning into at the moment. Here's where things differ. Republicans in the Senate want to move that group into the exchange after 1 year. So the federal government would basically be paying for them to buy insurance through the private marketplace.
And then what are the Democrats proposing?
The Democrats, being led by Governor Hassan, put forward an offer yesterday that moves them toward the same basic concept, but on a different timeline. They say that rushing to move people into the exchange in 1 year may not give enough time for other insurers to begin selling products on the exchange. Anthem, you'll recall, is the only vendor in 2014 2014. There's no guarantee that other insurance companies are going to start selling plans in 2015, though an extra 30,000 potential customers would likely entice some. But it takes months, if not longer, to get plans negotiated and priced and approved by regulators. So Democrats want to slow down that transition to the exchange. The Senate says if the will is there, New Hampshire can make this work.
And it doesn't sound as if the two sides are that far apart, or are they?
That's actually tough to know. While we had hearings today where committees approved these two concepts, the real negotiations continue to take place behind the scenes.
Scott Brown and his wife arrived in Nashua in his now-famous pickup truck. The Browns were preceded by about 100 protesters, mostly gun activists, who don't like Brown's past support for a ban on assault weapons.
It's clear why we're here. Scott Brown does not support New Hampshire values.
Media weren't allowed in the holiday party, but on his way in the back door, Scott Brown was asked if he'd seek office here. He said he'd deal with that question later, adding that his move to New Hampshire wasn't driven by politics.
Now, moving up here is personal, and looking forward to spending a lot of time with my family and my mom in particular, so that's about it.
Brown's visit to Nashua was his 13th appearance in the state since last spring. Throughout, Brown said a run for the Senate seat now held by Gene Shaheen was not off the table. A group called Ending Spending, Inc. has run web ads to encourage Brown to run and TV ads attacking Shaheen. Should Brown get into the race, he'd join Jim Rubens, a former state senator, conservative activist Karen Testerman, and perennial candidate Andy Martin in the Republican primary. Former U.S. Senator Bob Smith has also said he plans to run. For NHPR News, I'm Josh Rogers.
Tens and hundreds of millions of oysters used to grow naturally in the Great Bay Estuary, but disease and pollution have wiped out most of them. That has, in turn, been bad for the water quality in the bay. Oysters are filter feeders and eat algae and other organisms that are harmful to the Great Bay's ecosystem. Today, oysters are being farmed in the same brackish water that they grow in naturally, where rivers and ocean tides swirl together and form unique and rich habitats. The 8 oyster farms in New Hampshire are in Little Bay, which is one step closer to the ocean than Great Bay. And on the dock of Great Bay Marine, there's what looks like a little raft tied up. We get close and you hear the hum of a water pump. This is where Fat Dog Oyster Company is based.
So it all begins right here.
And this is Jay Baker. Until recently, he worked as an environmental regulator in Massachusetts. In what can only be described as a daring career change, he left his cushy desk job to jump headfirst into New Hampshire's nascent oyster farming industry. His new job is a different kind of animal.
This year, we've added this nursery system. It's called an upweller. Is it running?
No, that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's a problem?
Yeah, hang on a sec.
In this upweller, which is kind of like the aquaculture version of a hothouse, 1.5 million baby oysters are getting nutrient-rich water pumped right into their little filter-feeding mouths, as long as it's running.
If it's any consolation, it was making noise when I first walked out here.
Huh, so you broke it.
It's just a stick in the pump, and Baker's partner, Alex Boeri, a biology major fresh out of UNH, finds it after a moment.
All right, we're good. Welcome to oyster farming. Seriously, it's very important that runs, and that's why I don't sleep at night.
While the oysters are growing, they're filtering the water for free. Then, when they're full grown, Baker and Boeri can sell them to wholesalers and restaurants. The cleaner water is just an added perk. This year, they're hoping to bring their first crop to market. 3 years ago, those oysters were tiny like the ones at this upweller. Boeri scoops up a dab on the end of his finger.
And when we get it, it's 1.5 millimeters, so it looks like pepper flakes. Everybody calls them pepper flakes.
So that's probably, I don't know,
couple thousand oysters, easy.
Now, after 3 years...
As an AIDS outreach worker with Dartmouth Hitchcock in Nashua, it's Gene Adie's job to bring up the uncomfortable, like asking people about their risk factors for HIV.
I'm like, geez, you know, you're having unprotected sex. When was the last time you were tested? Oh, I've never been tested. Well, what do you mean you haven't been tested? I don't need to get tested. I'm not with anybody from Boston. That's sort of the mentality in New Hampshire. I mean, the image of the cozy, scenic, you know, New Hampshire, HIV is sort of hiding behind that.
Adie says she's constantly telling people HIV and AIDS are a threat, that the virus and those who live with it are in our communities.
If somebody were to look at me, they would say, wow, that's a really healthy person, and they would never, ever suspect that I had it.
This woman from the Monadnock region asked we not use her name. She's petite, energetic, a working mom who tested positive in 2003. Only her close friends know her status. Unlike cancer or cholesterol, it's a health topic that remains taboo for many.
It's really isolating for me. My experience is that I live in a small town, and I suspect that there are people in my town that probably are also HIV positive, but I don't know who they are. And I feel like I'm the only one. So sometimes it just feels really lonely.
She's one of about 1,200 people living with HIV in New Hampshire. The state has one of the lowest per capita rates in the country. And new data shows that for the past 5 years, the number of new infections has plateaued at about 50 a year, with most cases along the southern tier.
50 people a year is absolutely a good thing. But the question still remains, how many people don't we know about?
Susan McNeil is executive director of AIDS services for the Monadnock region.
How many people don't have access to care? How many people aren't getting tested because we don't seem to be able to have an infrastructure that supports effective prevention outreach?
McNeil says state funding for local AIDS organizations has been cut in half.
Before Ray Burton became an executive counselor in 1977, he was a school teacher and principal. And Burton brought a small-town school principal's pragmatism to the tens of thousands of votes he cast on state contracts and judicial and executive branch appointments. During high-profile confirmation hearings, Burton was fond of saying he saw the council's role as that of the board of directors of state government. But get Burton away from the council chambers and north of Concord, and he tended to talk about his job as if he were as much pastor as politician.
I'm always going to be there and available for people who are in their time of need. When someone calls and they have a problem, I want to be there in their dark hour, and I want to be there in their bright hour and when they have their celebrating hour, too.
And for decades, that was the Ray Burton approach. It kept him very busy. Here he is in 2005 talking up a typical schedule.
We got Bath Fireman's Supper tomorrow night. I'm spending all day Friday with Commissioner Stevens. You should come up and cover that. We're going to be visiting the Dream Team in North Conway. Very interesting group of people. Then Saturday, Sandwich Fair. I'm going to have my 57 DeSoto in the parade. I got things to do.
All that showing up, along with his attention to detail, made Burton a coveted ally for anybody who wanted to get things done in the North Country. Presidential hopefuls came calling, so would people looking to get a business off the ground or finagle a placement in a county nursing home. Burton gave all an audience, but tended to soft-pedal the power he had to fix things in his district or in Concord.
I'm just a chore boy on the side, you know, I'm just a country boy, way up north.
Yet Burton's ability to get things done, or at least seem as if he was always giving it his best, won him loyalty from voters that any politician would envy. And that came in handy during a brief hiccup in Ray Burton.
Up from the West Indies, cradle of hurricanes, moved the Terror, a pit of low atmospheric pressure into which the air rushed from all directions to form a whirling...
That's how a newsreel by the Federal Works Project Administration described the formation of what would become the legendary hurricane of 1938. On September 21st, the day it would arrive, Beatrice Dorsey was a 10-year-old living in Plainfield, New Hampshire. And she remembers being worried about that odd sky.
The sky there above my house was green. Pretty scary, that ominous green.
Dorsey, like other New Englanders, had no way of knowing that an incredibly powerful hurricane had formed and was headed her way.
For most people, it was a complete surprise.
Plymouth State Professor Lourdes Avilas has written a new book about the hurricane. It's called Taken by Storm, 1938. She says hurricanes were rare in New England. Big storms typically came up the East Coast and courteously veered out to sea. That's what forecasters figured this storm would do.
But this one didn't, because of the meteorological patterns at the time.
This storm's power increased. It became a hurricane, late in the afternoon smashing into Long Island and then southern New England. Sustained winds of 120 miles per hour combined with high tide.
The great wind-driven waves swallowed the sandy bulwarks of the coast, washed away the pleasant beaches of Long Island's southern shore, literally changed the coastline.
It's estimated almost 700 people died.
And the huge storm surge came in some places more than 20 feet. Especially in Providence, Rhode Island, they got one of the highest storm surges. And this is when most of the deaths occurred. People that were out and about.
Then the hurricane began moving inland.
Letting a wide pathway of ruin inward from the sea, the storm piled up property damage in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The quiet dignity of colonial meeting houses was reduced to broken lumber. In one brief hour, part of the ancient beauty that was New England's heritage vanished forever.
The highest wind measured during the storm was 186 miles per hour at the Blue Hill Observatory in Milton, Massachusetts. And Aviles calculates the hurricane was advancing about 50 miles each hour.
Once they figured out it was coming, it was too late to warn the population.
And there was no way to warn people in some rural areas. Many homes didn't have radios because they hadn't yet been wired for electricity, remembers Marjorie Trombley of Gilson. She was 11, living in a farmhouse with her mother and grandmother.
We didn't even know it was a hurricane until it was over. Imagine that, because we didn't have any electricity or anything like that.
It began with rain and some wind, but that didn't seem like it.
Where we live, on a dead-end dirt road in the White Mountains, the house lights of our neighbors are mostly out with the sun. We have three sets of neighbors, older couples, their children grown and gone. It's mostly the men I see, in whose lives I know a bit, divided though we are by a river, by trees, by a great horse field. All through the summer, as early as possible, nearly every day, and no matter what, neighbor one mows his lawn. Retired now, with 5 acres to tend, one prefers to chip away at the grass, an hour or so a day. On Monday, he slaloms the pines beside the river on a sit-down mower. On Tuesday, he jets across the horse field in a full-size tractor. At 6 a.m., neighbor two heads off to work in a big-bellied pickup, his left elbow locked in the open window. Sunglasses before sunup, great mustache like a black sheep on a cliff. His headlights scan our curtains as he turns down the road. He tiptoes his truck by us as quietly as he can. You hear more the tires crushing gravel than the grumble of engine. At the end of the day, if he sees me, he'll nod down over the wing of his elbow, as though I am a boy, as though he is passing high above me in a plane. Neighbor three lives on the river as we do. Excavators, bulldozers, cherry pickers come and go on his land. He turns trees into neat cords of wood and streamlines the earth around his part of the river so it never floods. It took years for me to discover that he was also a race car driver. Dirt tracks in the summer, ice ponds in the winter. Often the people you live closest to, you know the least. You take it slow with neighbors. While you've got all the time in the world, you don't have all the space. So you get to know them over the course of years and from a horizon of impressions. And the piecemeal story you put together about who they are is never right and never ends. Neighbor one, for example, stops mowing at 9 or 10. Exhausted, I suppose. He's reached his limit. I imagine him spent behind a checkered tablecloth, sipping lemonade, getting ready for tomorrow's rotten case of mildly tall grass. But then, I hear, he is a gardener, a green thumb, it is said. And on the far side of his yard, tipped from my view, he's brought up a stunning landscape. Rows of canoe paddle corn, huge red tomatoes inflate over polished curls of squash. The heart of his day is not lawn mowing, but a secret garden. There is no checkered tablecloth, no long lemonade ruminations. But this, I am learning, is what neighbors do best. Slowly, suddenly, they are someone else. The neighbor who lived in the house before neighbor one told me the moment he was leaving that his favorite thing in the world was hunting for a kind of extra wily goat on frozen mountains. Maybe, I reasoned, he meant the fast-hopping deer in the cold hills nearby. But in the very final moment we were neighbors, he dragged from his red barn the spectacular dragonfly of a helicopter, which is the thing about neighbors that's easy to forget. It doesn't happen often, but eventually there's a racing car. Suddenly, a secret garden. It could even be the very last moment when the helicopter comes flying out the red barn. But you can only go so long and be so blind to something so fantastic, so close, so far away. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
We live up in New Hampshire. We don't have lawns, we have pastures. When we go outside, we use lanterns. It's pretty dark in New Hampshire. Went to the city, got blown away, not a single pasture.
It's 5:32, and this is New Hampshire Public Radio News. I'm Brady Carlson. New Hampshire's highest court has unanimously upheld the conviction of the state's lone death row inmate. But as NHPR's Josh Rogers reports, the court must hold additional hearings before it decides if Michael Addison will be executed or serve life in prison.
In a 243-page decision, New Hampshire's Supreme Court found no reversible error in the conviction of former Boston gang member Michael Addison in the killing of Manchester police officer Michael Briggs. The justices wrote, Addison's sentence was not imposed under the influence of passion, prejudice, or any other arbitrary factor, and with sufficient evidence to support the jury's findings of aggravating circumstances. But before Michael Addison's sentence is imposed, New Hampshire law requires the court to also consider whether his death sentence is excessive compared to other similar cases. Michael Addison shot and killed Michael Briggs in a Manchester alley in 2006 after Briggs tried to stop Addison. Addison had earlier that week committed two armed robberies. If Michael Addison's death sentence stands, he'd be the first person executed in New Hampshire since 1939. For NHPR News, I'm Josh Rogers.
For the next 2 weeks, lawmakers will be in Concord to discuss Medicaid expansion, including an up or down vote. As NHPR's Todd Bookman reports, Governor Maggie Hassan says she's open to ideas for how to expand the health program, but wants to make sure any final plan works for the state.
Hassan and leaders of both parties have been meeting privately to discuss ways to expand Medicaid, but as of yet haven't hinted at a deal. Last month, a study commission recommended a plan put forward by Democratic Representative Tom Sherman that expands Medicaid for individuals earning up to about $15,000 a year, but relies on private insurance for some newly eligible. Hassan says negotiations with top Republicans may yield another approach.
We are open to their ideas, some of which are different than the ones in the commission report. At the end of the day, the ideas have to be workable and they have to be cost-effective for the state and for the people.
Senate Republicans are holding a press conference Thursday to discuss their vision for expansion. Any plan will need the approval of both chambers. A final vote is slated for November 21st. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Mostly cloudy skies across the state tonight with a chance of showers after midnight, lows in the low 40s to around 50 degrees. Tomorrow, rain expected across the state with temperatures in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Sunshine set to return on Friday. This is NHPR News.